Good news, citizens. We have got a superhero in studio. Find out who in just a second. Stay tuned.
You're tuning into the destination for TV superfan discussion, AfterBuzz TV. And now, let the buzz begin.
Welcome to AfterBuzz TV Spotlight. I'm Kylie Hodges, and you can tweet at me at the Kylie Hodges. And I'm so excited to say we've got a superhero in studio today. He's an actor, comedian, and also a fellow podcaster. So I better watch out because he's going to give me a run for my money. He plays the mild mannered accountant turned sidekick named Arthur in Amazon's first ever superhero series called The Tick to premiere this Friday, August 25th. Welcome, Griffin Newman.
Thank you so much for having me here. I really appreciate the fact that you refer to me as a superhero.
Well,
I think sidekick falls under the umbrella of superhero.
Yes.
I don't think the two terms negate each other. Some people fight me on this, especially my friends who are constantly trying to discredit me. But when I got the part and it was like announced, I ran to one of my old friends and she went like, "Oh my God, I'm so excited for you. You finally get to play a superhero's sidekick."
Well, here's the thing. Don't you think every great superhero isn't a hero without a sidekick?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the hero is like a group term more so than an individual.
Agree. And I think that sidekick, it's like superhero is the larger term and then anti-hero falls under that. Sidekick falls under that, you know?
Yeah.
I think superhero is the larger brand that I fall under. I don't know.
It sounds pretty cool,
though. I want credit. That's all I want.
You're getting that cred.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your character. His name's Arthur. Describe him for me, for all the people who want
to
know.
Yeah, he's the least likely person to be at the center of a superhero show ever imaginable. He is a dude who experienced this very traumatic event in his childhood. He witnessed his father dying as sort of collateral damage in this big superhero battle against the world's greatest supervillain, who everyone thinks is dead, was defeated. And he had a sort of mental breakdown, was institutionalized, was medicated, and was diagnosed a bunch of different ways and has been living this very kind of isolated, tentative life. Mild-mannered accountant by day, and at night he goes out and tries to prove that the terror is still alive. He's not trying to fight crimes, not trying to do anything. He's just sort of dismissed as a conspiracy theorist, but he needs to prove to himself and the world that he's not crazy and that this guy is still at large. And one night when he's out patrolling the streets with his binoculars, hiding in the shadows, not trying to get his hands dirty at all, this giant, big, gregarious blue guy comes up to him and goes, "You're supposed to be a superhero. Here's a suit. Be my sidekick." And the series is kind of his reluctant journey to actually fulfill what might be his destiny or maybe his nonsense, because this blue guy might not know what he's talking about.
Now, I had been familiar with The Tick. I remember watching the cartoon as a kid, and then I remember the live action about 10 or 15 years ago. And after watching some of the episodes leading up to it, he starts to wonder if he's seeing The Tick, if he's making this up. And I even had a moment where I was like, wait.
Yeah.
Is The Tick real?
Arthur hasn't always been able to trust his own brain, you know? And he's out to prove to everyone that he's sane, but he might be wrong, you know? Tick certainly doesn't seem any more sane than he is, or anything else that he's experienced in his life. But I think, I don't know, that's one of the things we're wrestling with throughout this this series and this season.
Tell me a little bit about his costume. It's moth-like.
Yeah. It's a moth suit. It is often misidentified as a bunny suit because of the antennas, which are very prominent.
Yeah.
But it has wings, and bunnies don't have wings, so it's clearly a moth suit. They spruced it up. I mean, because in the past, Arthur's always just kind of had this spandex onesie kind of number that is very unflattering.
Yeah.
doesn't really forgive any of the weirder parts of your body. And here they kind of spruced up, made it more of a high tech thing. So he's got this suit that has immense power, but he doesn't really know how to work it. He doesn't really know where it came from. The instructions are in a different language.
Mm-hmm.
So he's constantly trying to figure out how to use this thing. But it protects him, if nothing else. It's bulletproof, you know? And he is a very, very delicate man who could get hurt very easily. No sort of combat training or anything. It at least gives him a little bubble of security to stay alive.
What would you say? I know he's supposed to be like a civilian, but what is Arthur's superpower? Like, even as a person or, you know, what?
Yeah, yeah. I think Arthur's main superpower is awareness. You know, he's a very perceptive guy, and he pays a lot of attention to the little details, everything going on around him. He's sort of, you know, got like a Sherlock Holmes Jr. mind of trying to piece all of this together that comes from, I think, spending too much time on the internet following fringe theories and the like. And then I think a real solid sense of compassion and justice. You know, he really, he's not in it for the credit. He's not in it for the glory. You know, I think he just wants to do what's right. I think more than anything, he wants to stop other people from going through what he's gone through. And I think that's a superpower in a way, or at least a power, a non-superpower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about leading up to you getting on the show. Mm-hmm. What was going through the casting process like?
Insane. I mean, I went through the whole process going, well, there's no chance I'm actually going to get this.
Really?
So it will be cool to tell people that I got this far. And I kept on getting further. And I went, well, my story just got better. You know, when I tell people at a bar for 20 years, I was almost Arthur in the Tick. Now the story's gotten longer and more detailed, and then it just sort of happened. It was very weird. I mean, you know, I was a big fan of the previous versions. It was a character I was very attached to and felt very close to me. Not just close to me in that I cared about it, but close to me in that it's frighteningly close to me as a human being.
You identify with Arthur?
A lot. Probably
tell me about
too many
that.
Ways.
What is it in Arthur that you identify with the most?
I think that sense of, you know, the understanding of how you want the world to be, what you would like to be able to change, but feeling powerless to actually do anything about it. I relate to that a lot, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of people can, too.
Yeah, and Arthur's this guy who's just sort of been, like, ignored and pushed over by society. And I'm not trying to brag, but a homeless person once sat on me on the subway. Because he thought I was a chair. And people kept on being like, you're sitting on a person, and he didn't get it. I was writhing around, and he still couldn't acknowledge that I was a physical being with a body. So
maybe he just took a lot of comfort in you.
Right.
He connected with you.
I guess, emotionally.
Yeah.
But I, you know, so I've suffered that. I'm a little guy, and, you know, I feel like sometimes I'm sort of being cast off into the shadows. And Arthur's just, like, asking for his shot, I guess, to do what he thinks he's supposed to do. And that also maps really, like, one-to-one with being a struggling actor and comedian, which I have been for 9 years, leading up to getting this part, where you're not experiencing a lot of success, but you're sticking with it, even though it's mostly rejection facing you every day, because you think at some point it's all going to pay off. At some point, some giant blue guy's going to hand you a suit and give you a spotlight, you know? So I relate very hard to that. And throughout the course of doing this series, whatever Arthur was struggling with felt very one-to-one with what I was struggling with in trying to be a lead on a TV show of this size. You know, anytime he was overwhelmed by his circumstances and trying to just make things right, it was like, well, that's what I'm doing. I'm trying to make sure the show doesn't get canceled.
Well, so far you're doing great.
Thank you. The real credit when you ask how I got this part, Felicia Fasano was the casting director for the pilot, and she had been a really big champion of mine for years. I'm a New York guy, and I'm, like, born and raised. I'm very stubborn about trying to stay in New York just because I'm a broken person and a homebody, and I don't want to move. So you have to do a lot of self-taping, you know, where you record your own tape and send it to a casting director. And it's always, it feels like fighting an uphill battle very often. You feel like you're throwing pennies down a wishing well and you don't know if anyone's even going to watch your tape. And Felicia was this person who always would watch my tapes and I would send them in. For whatever reason, she decided that she, you know, was going to try to get me cast in something someday. And she'd get close and then something wouldn't work out. Someone in some position would turn me down or there'd be a scheduling problem or whatever it was. But she always kind of kept me in mind for stuff. And she said she read this script and said, I think this is the part where I can finally get Griffin cast. And I'm so thankful that it was this one, you know, and not like a singular commercial.
Right.
You know, that she put all the capital on this project. But I think she sensed that there was something similar else. I'd never met her in person. I didn't meet her until they flew me out to L.A. for the final screen test. But I did the same thing. I made my own tape with my manager's assistant, you know, the receptionist who was playing the Tick and going like, oh my god, I smell justice in the morning, which is a very different energy to play off of than what ultimately happens on screen.
Yeah.
So I was doing a lot of heavy lifting trying to make all that Arthur come through. But she showed my tape to Ben Edlin, who's the creator and showrunner, not just of this version of the Tick, but the entire history of the Tick, the comic book. He created the Tick when he was 17. He's been living with these characters for over 30 years. And he felt like I was, I don't know. I mean, you know, you make these decisions. Anytime I get an audition, there's always that battle of like, should I do what I think would be creatively most interesting? Or should I do what I think would maybe help me get the part? And a lot of times you do the latter and you kind of regret it, you know? You go, I was trying to do a crappier version of what they probably wanted, but that's not what I'm good at, and I made myself look worse in the process, and I was never going to get it. And if you do at least what you think is the best version you could do, you know, your own weird body and your own weird voice, what is in your wheelhouse, then, like, you can lose with integrity. And I did what I thought was going to be too weird to actually get hired. And somehow Ben was like, no, I think this guy is, you know.
The right amount of weird.
The right amount of weird. Ben's a very weird guy. It was very reassuring when I met him. And I went, oh, he's equally weird. Okay, we're both weirdos. But we sat down and we hit it off. And we had sort of very similar takes on what we want to do. Not just for this character, but what we're fans of in comedy and in TV and superhero fiction. And comic books and all that. And Valerie Curry had been cast, who was plays my sister Dot on the show. So they flew me out to screen test with her. They didn't have a Tick yet, so they couldn't really test that chemistry. And the audition was really kind of focused on the brother-sister stuff, which was interesting because it's a show that's so much about a superhero partnership. And I got cast mostly off of doing these dramatic scenes, you know, that were removed from the main thing. But that's when it felt kind of like, oh, I think they might actually be stubborn enough to push this show through and keep it this weird. A lot of times you read a good script, and by the time it makes it on air, it's, like, been watered down so much, and it's just kind of like, oh, well, they got rid of the thing that made it interesting.
And but you feel like they kept it pretty true to the original idea.
I think it just got weirder and weirder and weirder in a way that I love, you know? And I think it's weird sometimes because of the absurdity, the comic absurdity, and all these different weird characters and elements and plot twists that happen. But I also think the weirdest thing about the show is, amidst all this classic kind of superhero chaos and this very absurd comedy, you still always have these, like, very emotional scenes, these very human character-based scenes that aren't about driving the plot forward. They aren't about jokes. They're not about action set pieces. They're about, like, a brother and a sister who are both hurting a lot, or a sidekick and a superhero who just both feel like outcasts in this world. And that was always the stuff that felt the most transgressive to do. You know, when you're doing, like, a multi-page dialogue scene in a show like this that's actually just about the people. That always excites me.
You touched on what I think is a really interesting part of where TV's been moving in the past decade, where comedies aren't just comedies anymore.
Sure, sure.
Like, I keep thinking of Orange is the New Black. Mm-hmm. I used to always think it was a drama. And then it got nominated for a comedy. And it's, you know, everything's blurring the lines, but that's what's making so much great TV now, is you can't put it in a box because it's really touching on all of the great different emotions that people can relate to. And it's equally, if not more, entertaining.
Well, and that's the main thing that Ben Edlin and I talked about that first time we met for coffee after he'd seen my tape, was that I'm sort of obsessed and have always been obsessed with this sort of line between comedy and tragedy. Not to be pretentious about it, but
comedy is tragedy.
They're very, very close, right? Yeah. And I've always sort of had this, like, this windmill that I've always been tilting at in my life is trying to figure out how sad you can make something while still getting a laugh out of it, you know? And not a laugh where you're laughing at someone's misery,
right?
But just finding that fine line, because I feel like all my favorite comedies are really sad and all my favorite dramas are really funny, you know? And I love movies that are able to do that and TV shows that are able to do that, to get comedy out of serious circumstances or drama out of ridiculous circumstances. And I think that's when I, you know, start to go like, oh, I might actually get this part because he agrees with me in all this. That's the show he wants to make.
Yeah.
It's not me trying to convince someone to fit me in. It seems like they've actually created a window that I'm now the right person for. And somehow he was able to convince everyone else, which is still bizarre to think about.
What a gratifying feeling that you've pushed and pushed for a decade and you found the spot you fit right into.
Yeah. Thank you. And the right spot, you know? I mean, I just think about, like, so much in this whole process. I've been doing press for, like, 6 weeks now, having to talk about the show over and over again. And it makes you sort of take stock of everything and go, like, wow, this is bizarre that I'm actually in this position, that it worked out. And it's, like, it's a dream of mine to be entrusted with, like, a lead character on a show like this and get to handle so much of it and play so many different sides of things. But it also, it could have been a show I didn't really care about. it could be a remake of a property I love, like The Tick, but this new version feels like, you know, isn't living up to the past legacies. I just feel like I got really lucky in that it's like, this is the show I want to be on. You know, if nothing else creatively, like, this was the kind of tapestry that I always dreamed about being able to fit into. Hopefully people like it at this point. You know, that would be great. I'd love to be able to keep doing it.
Yeah.
But for me, just creatively working on it was like a dream come true.
Well, and this is Amazon's first ever superhero show. So yeah. I think that in itself is going to pull in a brand new audience. I think it has a lot of potential.
I hope so. I hope you're right.
Did you... Now, The Tick started out as a comic book, as you touched on earlier, I believe in the 80s.
Yeah.
And then the early 90s, there was the cartoon, which I remember watching as a kid. And then they made a live action on Fox with Patrick Warburton.
Right. That was sort of more of a sitcom. I have not.
They never brought him on set to intimidate.
I've met... No, to be muscle.
Yeah.
I've met Townsend Coleman, who was the voice of The Tick on the cartoon show.
Cool.
And he, without revealing any spoilers, plays a role in our season.
Very cool.
Eagle-eyed listeners. You know, eagle-eyed listeners. That term makes sense. might recognize his voice if you're paying attention.
Ooh.
But I really, I haven't met Patrick. I haven't met the other guys who have played Arthur. There are three other people. Two dudes from the cartoon show, Rob Paulsen and Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees played Arthur. And then David Burke played him on the 2001 show. And I kind of want to meet them because I feel like we're cousins now or something.
You're sort of, you have something in common.
Yeah.
You should have an Arthur Tick reunion.
Yes.
All the past Ticks, all the past Arthurs
that would
get
be
together
really
for happy hour.
Right, right, exactly. And then Ben draws full-size drawings of the characters to represent the comic versions. Yeah.
That sounds fantastic to me. Give me some behind-the-scenes scoop. What was the dynamic like on set? You know, this is a fun show.
Yeah.
But was it always fun and games? Were there really...
No, it was work. It was work. I mean, you work really hard to make it fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
What is, like,
which
your most
me
vivid
being
memory on set,
but it's,
though?
Like, what's my most vivid memory? That's a good question.
Or maybe the craziest moment, like, something was going awry and it came out great.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to say this without spoiling anything. There's a character he's introduced pretty early on, so I think I can say this. There's a character who plays a big role over the course of our season who's a talking dog. And you get to a point where you're like however many episodes in and you're doing multi-page dialogue scenes with a dog.
Wonderful.
And none of it feels weird to you anymore. It's just a day at work, you know? And there's a dude standing over your shoulder with a piece of meat on a stick. Because if they don't put the meat next to your face, then the dog won't look in your direction.
You're literally just a piece of meat to him.
Yeah, and you're trying to emotionally reason with a dog. And that just felt like, God, if this works, we're doing something interesting. And if it doesn't, I'm going to look so stupid.
What is the dog's name in real life?
Oh, God, that's a good question. There were two different dogs in there.
Oh.
And I can't remember their names.
Now they
had,
you know.
They had one dog who they said was better at stunts and one dog who was better at dialogue. And I said, what do you mean the dog's better at dialogue?
His English is better.
They said he's better at looking at people and making it look like he's talking. He doesn't move his mouth, but he's just better at eye contact.
Wow.
Which makes him better at dialogue.
Yeah. That sounds like a dog you'd want to keep around, like, emotionally.
Yes.
He's a good listener.
I'll say
sounds
that,
like a great boyfriend,
that dog
too.
Was one of the best actors I have ever worked with. It was stunning.
Somebody give that dog an Oscar.
Yeah.
Did you have to do any crazy prep for the role?
You know, I went pretty obsessively down the rabbit hole of trying to cover everything that has existed in the Tick universe up until now, tracking down every comic, rewatching every episode of the two different shows. I just tried to sort of like live in that world as much as possible. But I was kind of, you know, lucky and unlucky that I felt like I related to Arthur immediately upon reading the script. And I already was a fan of the previous version, so I had a sense of how he needed to function in order to work. So it was more like, I've said sometimes with acting, it's like you're on the beach with a metal detector and you're just trying to find something. You don't really know what you're going to do and you're looking for some place to like plant yourself. And this, it was like from the moment I read the script, I knew where the X was on the beach. And it's just been digging and digging and digging and digging. It isn't easy. You break a lot of sweat, you know, and you have a lot of strain, but it's just been trying to go deeper and deeper into, you know, sort of what I thought the character was. But it's nice also because Arthur's like the one superhero who notably is not physically in shape. and meant to be a superhero. So every other person who plays a superhero goes like, oh, I could only eat rice for 6 months.
Right. I did jujitsu for eight years.
I film for 14 hours a day, and then I have to be in the gym for 4 hours a day. And it was like, I was ordering pizza every night. You know, I'm the one superhero where they complain that I'm like too skinny. So
You're a lucky man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I want to go back in time a little bit.
Sure.
You've been acting for around a decade now.
Yeah.
As a child, did you always know you wanted to be an actor?
I always knew I wanted to be in this world. Mm-hmm. I just always was like very, very singularly obsessed with movies and TV and comedy. But I think it always kind of shifted where I wanted to fit into all of that. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, very interested in acting young. I started doing stand-up when I was like 10 years old around New York City.
Wow. There's some tough crowds out there.
Yeah, yeah, it was brutal. 8-year-old hecklers are not fun.
Do you need like a permission slip to do stand-up comedy as a child?
Is this woman Joanne Grossman who started this program? I was in the early days of it, but it's still going on now. It's been going on for like 20 years, and she had this idea to book out comedy clubs on like Sunday afternoons when they weren't going to be doing a show, and have kids do stand-up for like audiences of families. So it was like, I wasn't like going out and working the clubs every night, yeah, chain smoking out back with Dave Attell. It was like, you know, this very supervised thing. And it was sort of like my version of like Little League. You didn't get paid for doing it. They never paid us. But it was sort of like, okay, once a month on Sundays, I get up and I do my like 10 minutes, which, you know, were very, very bizarre. It was, you know, the other kids were doing like homework jokes mostly and like bully jokes and stuff like that. And my dad is and was obsessed with politics. So he worked a lot during the week. And when a lot of the time I would spend with him was on the weekend. But on Sunday, he just wanted to watch Meet the Press and David Brinkley and all those shows. So it's like if I wanted to bond with my dad, I had to watch those shows with him. So I very quickly realized my currency was if I could make jokes about the politicians on those shows. So I would get up and do stand-up about politicians.
Oh.
And I was like 4'8". I had the highest pitch voice of all time. No clothes fit me. And I got up and did like Bill Clinton impressions and stuff. So it was this very bizarre like robot act. It felt like I was like a trained, you know, monkey or something, yeah, that my parents had forced me to do these. Jeez, I wasn't making jokes about policy or anything. I was making like very base level jokes about politicians' personalities.
Still, I'd say that's ahead of your time. Any child making political jokes is...
It was
That's
weird.
Funny in itself.
It was very weird. I watch the tapes now and I go, like, what am I talking... I still don't understand what I'm talking about here. But it was always, yeah, shifting around. And there was a period of time where I was very angsty and self-serious 15-year-old. And I just wanted to write plays. And I didn't want to be in the spotlight. And acting is lame, you know. It always just sort of circled around. But I always just... I loved movies and TV and superheroes and comic books and comedy and just wanted to be doing something. So the last 10 years have been just sort of trying to get in from any angle I can, you know, working anything I can. But this really is kind of a dream job for me.
Now, you do stand-up. Mm-hmm. Do you have any stand-up shows coming up? Super busy with The Tick, I assume.
But. You know, I'll say this. I kind of had to go on a sabbatical when I was filming because it was pretty all-consuming.
Yeah.
And it's been the press tour after this. So I haven't done a stand-up show since January, but I'm going to...
Do a comeback tour?
Be opening for my friend August 29th. Is
That's
Tuesday.
In a week.
Is that Tuesday? Yes.
Yeah,
New York City,
Tuesday.
The Pitt Theater, which is on 24th Street, 123 24th Street. My good friend Alejandro Collini is doing his new one-man show called Professor Insano Destroys Reality, and cool. I'm going to be opening up for him and trying to get my feet slowly back into the water.
Yeah.
It's scary, though, because it's like stand-up is so much about the consistency of doing it over and over again, and mm-hmm. I'm worried that I've like totally atrophied now, you know?
You got it. You should just hit up some open mics and let people throw tomatoes at you there.
That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to the open mic scene. Yeah, but I hopefully I'll be doing stand-up more now that, you know, the show is out there.
Yeah.
And I can kick back a little bit and not have to put on the moth suit for a little bit.
Air it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me a little bit about your podcast. It's called Blank Check with Griffin and David.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I host it with one of my best friends, David Sims, who is a film critic and entertainment writer for The Atlantic. And we became friends through – we were trivia teammates. There's this very, very hyper-intense, nearly violent movie trivia night at this bar called Videology in Brooklyn that's really, really great. But like hardcore nerdery season sort of tournament kind of things. And we are both sort of similarly obsessed with movies. And actors and directors and all of that, but also would always be fascinated by careers, you know? And, like, that's so interesting. That person chose to do that after this. They had a big hit then, and they decided to do that or rebrand themselves this way. People making risky moves and whether they paid off or not. So our podcast is sort of about that from the director side of things. Directors who have, like, a big, big success early on and then have some cachet, as we like to say, have blank checks to make whatever crazy passion projects they want, because people can't really define what worked last time, but they just go like, I don't know, I just trust you, do that thing you did. You know, someone like the Wachowskis, who make The Matrix out of nowhere, and then everyone's like, make another Matrix, and they make Speed Racer, which is an insane movie, you know? Yeah. And a movie that I think everyone hated at the time, and I think is brilliant, and people are slowly kind of coming around to, because it's just this bizarre, out of nowhere, like, it's like this anti-capitalist, like, day glow racing epic.
they had to get it out of their system.
But that's fascinating to me that they would make that movie after making three Matrix movies when people just would expect them and probably ask them to just keep on making weird, dark, leathery techno thrillers for the rest of their lives. So we pick a director and we go through all of their films one episode at a time. We'll have guests on, but we sort of look through the arc of their career and try to figure out ultimately what was, you know, the unifying theme, you know.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
You talked about The Dark Knight, and that's one of my favorite movies.
It's
and
a popular one.
I really
it's
enjoyed listening one. To that
Thank
one.
You. Yeah, we're finishing up Christopher Nolan right now, and then we're about to start doing Catherine Bigelow, which I think will be really fun. Yeah.
That's a good choice.
She's got a weird all-over-the-place filmography.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is pinned on your Twitter account. In 2013, you said, Michael Keaton's hair in the Batman movies gives me daily hope that I might be able to play a superhero someday. Life has come full circle. How do you feel now?
Pretty surreal. I think I'm going to retire.
Yeah.
I've been struggling a lot lately because I don't actually know what my ambitions are anymore. This show was like the five things I hope someone would someday let me do all in one job. Mm. So now I have to like draft up a whole new list. But
well, that's a good problem to have.
Yeah, yeah. I was rewatching Batman Returns probably for like the 800th time that year. And I just noted, like, you know, how unconventional Michael Keaton looks in that movie and how they style him and everything. Such an unusual choice to play Bruce Wayne. I still think he's
the
best
Batman.
That was
a weird movie.
I love that movie. But I just had that thought where I was just like, Michael Keaton's hair kind of looks like my hair. You know? And no one who's in a superhero movie now has hair like me.
Right.
So I tweeted that out. And then, the second I got cast as the Tick, I was like, that tweet. And I dug through, found it, pinned it, just wanted to show everyone, like, look, I called it. Which I still can't believe I did. It feels like I tricked everybody.
So that was almost four-ish years ago.
Just about, yeah.
In 4 to 5 years from now, where would you like to see yourself? I know it sounds like maybe you need to sit down and make a vision board before you can answer that question.
I'll tell you what my last, like, really big ambition that wasn't conquered by this project, right? That wasn't checked off by this project. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'll draft up new ideas. The last one that's still the outlier, I desperately want to be part of the Fast and Furious franchise.
Wow.
I love the Fast and Furious franchise. I feel like my type is unrepresented in those movies.
Yeah.
Namely, nebbishes who don't have driver's licenses.
You don't have a driver's license?
I don't have a driver's license. I grew up in New York. Cars scare me. I've never driven a car in my life.
Wow.
And I feel like, you know, the Fast and Furious movies are so much about inclusiveness
cars?
And family.
True.
But, yes. Like, there's no representation of people who don't know how to drive cars. So, would I love to be part of the team, roll with Dominic Toretto and the gang? Yes, I would love that, obviously. But also, I feel like if it was just a part where they walk into an office and I'm like, oh, excuse me, you need a pass to come through here. And then they hold up a gun. I go, that's fine, come in. I could do that. Anything. I just want to be in one of the Fast and Furious movies.
I like the concept. I should trademark this. Mm-hmm. You're the star, and it's Fast and the Furious too slow. They're inducting you to their gang and teaching you how to drive.
Okay, here's
and
my
be a driver.
Here's my big pitch. This is what I think it could be. Okay,
that didn't go well.
No, I like that. I think that's totally good.
I'm just trying to get you the biggest role possible out of the franchise.
So here's my like my greedy pitch for like okay, if you really you know. I'm like a tech guy. I'm a benefactor. I'm some sort of like bureaucratic
hacker.
Position. They already
there
have a couple
go.
Hackers, which is why, you know, two hackers on one team don't need a third one. But I'm some sort of bureaucrat, some stuff shirt who they bring onto the team for some logistical reasons. But at some later third act point in the movie, they're all incapacitated or kidnapped. And the only way to save the day is for me to get behind the wheel of a car, even though I've never driven before.
There's the drama. I think
every audience, like, suddenly it's like an underdog sports movie, you know? It's like Fast and Furious meets Air Bud. You're like, can the dog play basketball? Can this kid drive the car?
You're a new Herbie the Love Bug.
Can he save Vin Diesel?
Yeah.
So that's, if I'm getting greedy, that's the role I would like to play. But I don't want to write the movie for them unless they want to pay me, in which case I would happily write 12 Fast and Furious movies. I have a notebook full of ideas.
Well, knock on wood, you put it out in the universe.
I'll pin the tweet.
Yeah. Pin that tweet. And in 4-ish years, I expect you to be back here talking about Fast and the Furious.
Fingers crossed.
Learning how to drive.
Yeah. Fast 12 Furious.
There'll probably be 100 by then. There's so many Fast and Furious movies.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to get in there before they go to space. I think we're like 3 or 4 away from them going to space just because of like escalation.
Yeah.
And I want to have one good terrestrial Fast and Furious movie, and then I'll follow them to space. I'll follow them anywhere. I love them. I love Vin Diesel.
Well, Griffin, it was so great having you in the studio. Nice. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Yeah.
Please tell everybody listening when they can tune into The Tick and where they can follow you on social media.
Sure. August 25th, Amazon Prime. It's an Amazon Prime subscriber exclusive. So, you know, just sign up now. Get that free shipping. Order a bunch of deodorant and watch The Tick August 25th. And then, yeah, you can listen to my podcast, Blank Check, with Griffin and David, not on Griffin and David. The podcast doesn't happen on us. It happens through us.
Right.
And that's available on iTunes, app, podcast, any place where podcasts exist. And then I'm Griff Lightning on all social media platforms, like Grease Lightning, but with my name.
Griff.
Yeah.
Love it. And you can follow me on Twitter at @TheKylieHodges. Griffin, again, thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure.
This was fantastic.
Yeah,
can't wait to watch The Tick on Friday. Thank you guys so much for watching. See you next time.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
And it's like this.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.